But today you're welcome to comment if you have something to say in response to some of the questions. You know, the title of our lesson today sounds, you know, almost like a good soap opera title. It's Jesus Christ on Hatred, Lust, and Lies. That sounds pretty saucy, doesn't it? And so we're talking about three pretty major things here, but things that Jesus spoke about and things that we need to learn about. And Jesus was very straightforward about the danger of hatred and unbridled and unjustified anger. Jesus was very specific about the danger of unbridled lust. And Jesus was very pointed about the danger of dishonesty and untruths and being evasive with the truth. And God wants us to be people of peace. God wants us to be people of purity. And God wants us to be people of truth. And I hope that that's what we can leave here today being reminded of as we think of the Sermon on the Mount, this text from Matthew chapter 5, verses 17 through 37. So we're going to start here with verses 17 through 20. Let me move a couple of things around so that I can see this a little better myself. Jesus says, "Do not think that I have come to abolish the law or the prophets. I have not come to abolish them, but to fulfill them. For truly I say to you, until heaven and earth pass away, not an iota, not a dot will pass from the law until all is accomplished. Therefore, whoever relaxes one of the least of these commandments and teaches others to do the same will be called least in the kingdom of heaven. But whoever does them and teaches them will be called great in the kingdom of heaven. For I tell you, unless your righteousness exceeds that of the scribes and Pharisees, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven." So those are some interesting words from Jesus, and we want to start out just kind of thinking about some of the things that he has said here. So take a look at some of our questions as we move on through here. Let me see if I hit the right button there. All right. The question number one, and these questions, by the way, are on our website, lccoc.net. And so you can grab these questions before you come to class. I just finished up next week's questions, so I don't think they're up there quite yet, but they'll be up there within a day, I'm sure.
They're up there, Josh.
Oh, they're up there? I can't remember. Josh, my mind is spinning so many. I can't even remember if I sent them to you. So, hey, thank you.
You did. I got them up this afternoon. I just didn't get back to you yet. So, thanks.
Okay. Great. So, thank you, Josh. Josh Neville's been posting that stuff to our website to help me out, save a little bit of time, and I appreciate that. All right. So, from time to time, what was one of the accusations made against Jesus and his apostles in the following passages? Let's take a look at some of these passages. Matthew chapter 12 and verse 2. What's the accusation there? In a nutshell.
They're doing things that are not lawful.
You're doing things that are not lawful. Okay, good. So Jesus, you're not following the law. Jesus, you don't respect the law. What about John chapter 5? There's a healing that takes place in John 5. You remember what day that was that it took place? Sabbath day, right? And on the Sabbath day, it's so what is Jesus told in John chapter 5, verses 16 and 18? What's he accused of?
I mean, it reads, this is why the Jews were persecuting Jesus, because he was doing these things on the Sabbath. But Jesus answered them, "My Father is working until now, and I am working."
Yeah, right. And then verse 18, the Jews sought all the more to kill him because he not only broke the Sabbath, so breaking the Sabbath to them was being a lawbreaker. In fact, the same thing is said about Paul in Acts chapter 21. That's what starts this big riot when Paul goes to Jerusalem, and some of the Jews are basically trying to get him killed. And they knew there are certain catchphrases, there are certain things that you could say, certain buzzwords that would really get people riled up with Paul. And the thing that they say in Acts chapter 21 in verse 20 is one of the things they say in verse 20, "You see, brother, how many myriads of Jews there are who have believed, and they are all zealous for the law, but they have been informed about you that you teach all the Jews who are among the Gentiles to forsake Moses, saying they ought not to circumcise their children. And so even the Christians knew, Paul, there's a people who are saying things about you. And one of the things they're saying is that you want to get rid of the old law. And then when you look at Acts 21, verse 27, it says the 7 days were almost ended. Paul had taken a vow, and the Jews from Asia, seeing him in the temple, stirred up the whole crowd, laid hands on him, crying out, saying, "Men of Israel, help. This is the man who teaches all men everywhere against the people, the law, and this place." Okay? And they say, and besides that, he's brought some Greeks in here and defiled the holy place, which wasn't true. It was a false accusation. But there were certain things that some of the Jews were accusing Jesus of, and they accused Paul of later. And one of those is that you don't respect the law. You want to destroy the law. You're not having respect for it. So rather than destroying the law, what does Jesus say he came to do? How does he answer this in Matthew 5?
Talks about that he came to fulfill the law. So if they were able to see the bigger picture, they would see all prophecies fulfilled and Jesus is actually accomplishing God's will. Instead, they're very busy looking at just every little detail and kind of nitpicking what he's doing rather than seeing he's there to fulfill it.
Okay. Good, good. So Jesus explicitly says here, "I did not come to destroy the law, but to fulfill it." So I want to think for a minute about what that means. What does it mean for Jesus to say that he fulfilled the law? So I want to quote to you from what I think is a good illustration of this. This is from John Smith's book that he's written on the Sermon on the Mount. He says, Jesus declared that it was never his intention to destroy or abolish the law. It would be impossible for him to defeat the purpose of the law and still accomplish his mission. Instead, he came to carry out the promise and purpose of the law. And with the purpose of the law completed, the law could be removed without having been violated. Now, I really like how he illustrates it in this next quotation. He says, for instance, if two men enter into a contract and each meets the terms of the contract, it is fulfilled and it is accomplished. There are no more demands on either party as a result of this fulfilled contract. It was not destroyed, but rather it was fulfilled. In the same way, Jesus came to complete the law that man might be released from the burden of the law. And I think that's a great way to illustrate this in a way that we can understand. And I hope that it's helpful to you as you think about it. So what were some of the ways, by the way, that Jesus did fulfill the law? What does he do to fulfill it? Has anyone ever perfectly...
fulfilled it, didn't he?
Go ahead, Phil. Yeah.
His dying fulfilled it. That was the end of the law when he died, wasn't it?
Okay, his dying fulfilled it. One of the requirements of the law was that that someone had to die. And so Jesus takes that punishment of death for our sake. And so the law is fulfilled by Jesus dying, and yet because Jesus is innocent, he's able to offer forgiveness through his innocent, his sinless blood. He perfectly observes it. Nobody has ever perfectly observed the law. Jesus perfectly observed it. And that's why we can't argue Jesus was a lawbreaker. He wouldn't be worthy of fulfilling the law had he been a lawbreaker. He's our perfect sacrifice. But I want to get to this question too. Because he's fulfilled the old law, does this mean that we're under no law today?
No, we're under the law of Christ now.
Okay. Yeah, 1 Corinthians chapter 9, verse 21 speaks of the law of Christ. And I think sometimes people misunderstand some of these passages that talk about the doing away of the law. Well, yes, we are no longer under the law of Moses. That has been done away. That contract has been fulfilled. But we are under the law of Jesus Christ, which is referred to in various ways in the New Testament. So I wanted to take a minute to think about that, just that short passage there in Matthew 5, 17 through 20. But I want to jump into the actual, law that he is establishing really, which begins in verses 21 and continues on through verse, well, continues on quite a ways, but we're just going to study through verse 37 here today. All right. So let's take a look at this passage in verses 21 through 26, because the title of our lesson is Christ on Hatred, Lust, and Lies. In this section, it's about the hatred part, the anger part. So Jesus says, you have heard that it was said to those of old, you shall not murder, and whoever murders will be liable to judgment. But I say to you that everyone who is angry with his brother will be liable to judgment. Whoever insults his brother will be liable to the council. Whoever says, you fool, will be liable to the hell of fire. So if you're offering your gift at the altar, and there remember that your brother has something against you, leave your gift there before the altar and go. First, be reconciled to your brother, and then come and offer your gift. Come to terms quickly with your accuser while you are going with him to court, lest your accuser hand you over to the judge and the judge to the guard, and you be put in prison. Truly, I say to you, you will never get out until you have paid the last penny. All right. Let's think about this text a little bit. And I would love to have an entire lesson on each chunk of this text, because it's really, this is some very rich teaching. But we're just trying to get the big picture points here out of these texts, and certainly have a few nuggets we can take home with us. Notice, first of all, this method that Jesus is about to begin using in verses 21 through 48. He over and over again says, you have heard that it was said, but I say to you. And there's a contrast that he's using to make his points as he goes through this sermon, if you will. So Kenny Chumley says this: 6 times in verses 21 through 48, Jesus uses the formula, ye have heard that it was said. In each case, the contrast is not between the law of Moses. Notice, if it was the law of Moses in every case, Jesus would have said, it is written. But he says, you have heard that it was said. So the contrast is not between the law of Moses and the gospel, but between rabbinic teaching, it has been said, and the gospel. So in this first example, Christ draws attention to the sixth commandment and what the rabbis taught about the sixth commandment. And that sixth commandment condemned murder. And what the people had been taught was correct. Yes, you have heard that it was said that you shall not murder, and whoever murders will be in danger of judgment. Homicide was wrong. Murderers were accountable for their actions. But moving on through this quote, on I say unto you, see verse 18, the problem with the scribal teaching on murder, though, was that it didn't go far enough. Christ radically enlarges the common interpretation by going behind the act to the motive, to declare that the attitude of anger that underlies murder is equally culpable before God. So the real issue is the inner spirit of murder with which we view other people. And so I think that's such a key point. In the old law, yes, murder was forbidden. Yes, the rabbis taught against murder. And for most people, this makes it pretty easy because most people haven't murdered physically, but Jesus goes beyond the symptom and he deals with the disease. And so he basically says the real reason people murder is because of a lack of respect for human life and dignity, because of an anger that is unjustified. And so the problem starts in the heart. So let's think about this a little bit. Jesus is addressing the issue of murder, the issue of anger. Is there such a thing? Let me ask this question, which isn't on your sheet, but is there such a thing as justified anger? What kind of anger is he addressing? Does he just say whoever is angry with his brother, period?
Selfish anger, I would think. Just purely an emotion.
Okay. He says specifically, whoever is angry with his brother without a cause. There's no real good reason for you to be angry with your brother. And so there is such a thing as justified anger. In Ephesians chapter 4, Paul writes, be angry and sin not, though. So there's a right way and a wrong way to handle our anger, to deal with our anger. Now, how might we see this sin manifest itself? Unbridled, unjustified anger. What three things does he specifically mention in verse 22, which are expressions of how anger, murder in the heart, occurs?
Well, he talks about the different things that people will say or that they'll lash out in saying to, and three different consequences that come with those. The last one, talking about being, several times you see in the Bible when someone is called a fool is someone who doesn't regard God, which that would certainly fit with some of what Jesus is saying there.
Mm-hmm. Good. So in verse 22, you're angry without a cause. So there's a first problem, unjustified anger. The second thing that will happen, whoever says to his brother, Raka, what does that mean? I've been called a lot of things, but I've actually never been called Raka that I can remember. What does that mean?
Means empty headed.
There you go. Yeah, I have been called that probably, but not Raka. So Raka is like an Aramaic quasi swear word. And that's what it means. It means empty head. It's declaring someone that you are worthless or you're an imbecile. That's probably one of the best words that we would have today. And so Jesus is condemning the person who would call someone worthless or an imbecile. How many people, don't raise your hand, but I mean, you can raise your hand, an emoticon if you want, but how many have ever kind of said something like that to someone? You're worthless. You're an imbecile. Jesus condemns that. Jesus says that comes from a heart, that is full of anger. Those are the beginnings of murder in the heart. Now, he also mentions whoever says you fool, and fool means stupid. That's the word that we would use, or the closest equivalent today. So any use of speech that's intended to slander and to vilify another person's character is condemned by Jesus. And there's a reason for that. God thinks you're worth something. Okay? God thinks every person is worth something. He's created us in his image. And so we're not supposed to call anybody worthless because we've been created by God. We are of great worth. And we're not supposed to call, anyone fool or stupid because we are the creation of God. And that's not just insulting the person. That's insulting God, the creator, who created people. And so we need to be careful about what we say. So what do we do when we're in that situation? What is Jesus, when we're in a situation where there's a rift between, us and someone else, what does Jesus encourage us to do here with that problem?
Josh, I think it's interesting that when you look at the first murder that we have in the Bible, before Cain committed the murder, he was basically told this same thing. Mm-hmm. you're going down this wrong path and you're going to end up committing murder. And so we see that. And so, Cain in Genesis was basically told, make this right, help to make this, don't let this go any further. And he didn't, and he ended up, killing his brother. And so it's kind of interesting again that we kind of see this shadow in Genesis of this teaching.
Okay. Good, good. This is a whole new world, right? I never have had to deal with dogs barking in a Bible study at the church building. So this is totally different. And I have called my dog worthless before, I'm pretty sure, when
we had that exact conversation here in the last 2 minutes.
Just, okay.
They're being very rowdy.
Mine is being quiet right now, so I'm thankful for that. So if you see me give this like look at someone, it probably means go get the dog, right? Okay. So Michelle says on the chat, she says one of the things we need to do is make peace quickly. And I think that's exactly what Jesus is teaching here. That this needs to be taken care of, and it needs to be taken care of quickly. I wanted to read this quote to you because I thought this was a good point also that Chumley brought out in his commentary. He says, insulting language, that's name calling. It could be racial. It could be ethnic. It could be social slurs that demeans a fellow human being is condemned by God. It's also worth noting that an ungodly attitude toward another can manifest itself in silence as well as in speech. G.B. Shaw says silence is the most perfect expression of scorn. Sometimes when we won't give someone the time of day, that's an expression of anger too, right? And he goes on to write, giving another the silent treatment or a cold shoulder, that can be as ungodly as the use of insulting derogatory language. Some people just go about their anger differently than others. In any situation, whether it be the silent treatment method or the, you know, I'm going to call you a rockin' fool and just tell you what I really think about you, Jesus wants us to fix these things quickly. How effective is our worship going to be if we're at war with God's creation?
Not real good.
Yeah. Okay. Right. Not very effective, you know? It's a little bit hypocritical to come before God and praise Him, and to thank Him for His church and maybe be at odds with your church family. And so God wants us to fix whatever, you know, rifts or issues exist between us. And so take a look at the language. In verse 23, I want you to catch the therefore, right? You've heard the phrase, whenever there's a therefore, you need to ask what it's there for. Well, therefore connects what he's just said, which is don't call people fool or raka or insult people. And if there is that type of strife between you and someone else, if you bring your gift to the altar and there remember that your brother has something against you, leave your gift and go your way. So what Jesus is saying is, I don't want you to come worship if you haven't fixed your problem with your brother. There's actually something that comes before worship, and the priority before worship is that you fix this situation that has caused the two of you to be at odds, enemies. And so he says, leave your gift, go your way first. Okay, so the priority is first be reconciled to your brother and then come and offer your gift. Okay, so there's something that needs to happen before we can worship. And so this really expresses the importance of trying to correct whatever issues exist between us and others. Now, notice this as well. It says, if you remember that your brother has something against you. So think about that. This isn't, I have something against someone. I just happen to know that there's someone who has something against me. I know there's somebody that's upset with me, that's angry with me, that right now isn't, you know, at peace with me. It says you have a responsibility, and it doesn't say whether they're justified or not, or whether you think it's a frivolous excuse or not. You have a responsibility to go to them and try to correct that before you can effectively worship. A couple of comments in the chat box. Kevin says the poor in spirit views himself differently through God's eyes and would see his brother differently also. And I think that's a good connection, Kevin, to the Beatitudes in Matthew chapter 5, having an attitude where we are poor in spirit. It's an arrogant attitude that doesn't want to correct things with one another. The poor in spirit realizes, hey, we've sinned, other people have sinned, we might be at fault, we might be at odds, and we need to try to communicate these things and forgive one another through them. Okay, so Zip says, it's hard to worship when you are at odds with anyone, or allowing the worldly concerns to cloud your thoughts regardless the reason. And I think that's a great point, Zip, which speaks to the importance of trying to come to worship with a clear head, come before God with a clear head and a clear heart. So thanks for those comments. So what do we need to do? What do we need to do to try to make some of these things right?
I'll point out that Jesus describes what's going to happen to somebody if they have this in their heart. And then he says this. So we need to have a great concern for other people's, you know, especially our brother's heart and his soul. You know, what if we, you know, if we just hear this from Jesus and then we think, well, that's his problem if he's got that against me, but we don't care that this person may be before God in judgment and still not have this problem fixed. You know, if we don't care about that, then that says something about our own heart. So we need to make sure that we take what Jesus said seriously and be a little bit more concerned with their state as well. Their heart state. That's why Jesus said what he said.
Yeah. Good thought. I want you to take a look at verses 25 and 26 because sometimes I think people have a little bit of trouble with those two verses, but I really think all it is, verses 25 and 26 are a legal illustration of what you would do if you were on your way to court and you didn't want to have to put this in the hands of a judge. Okay. And you and the person that you're at odds with, you're on your way to court. I don't know about you, but if there's any way that I can settle things out of court, it doesn't matter what it is, you know, a car accident, whatever. I don't want to go to court. I don't know who this judge is going to be. I don't know if they're going to be kind to me or unfavorable to me. I want to try to settle things as much as I can personally and not have to take something to court. And I think that's the illustration that Jesus is using in verses 25 and 26. Agree with your adversary quickly while you're on the way with him, lest your adversary deliver you to the judge. In other words, settle out of court. All right. And then he said, here's what could possibly happen. The judge hands you to the officer. You get thrown into prison. In the time of Christ, if you were fined by a judge and you didn't have any family to help, you had to stay in jail until the fines were settled. And if you didn't have any family or friends that had any money and they were willing to help, you could stay in jail forever. And so verse 26, that's what the meaning is. I say to you, you're not going to get out of there until you've paid the last penny. And so don't put this in the hands of a judge. Don't put this in the hands of someone who may not know the situation as well when you can settle the situation yourself. Try to settle things in the smallest group possible first before it gets brought to other people. And I think that's the principle of Matthew 18 as well. It's just looking at it from the opposite vantage point. Matthew 5 is saying, if you know someone has something against you, you go try to settle it with them. Matthew 18 is saying, if you have something against someone, then you go settle it with them. And you do that before you bring two or three more and before you get the church involved. So there's a certain process to how you settle these things. You know, the people who are closest to the situation, it's best that they can settle it amongst themselves first before others get involved. And it doesn't mean we don't need a judge sometimes. That doesn't mean we don't need the two or three sometimes. But that is the ideal way to try to handle things first, according to Matthew 5 and Matthew 18. All right, so we've got a lot more text here to get to, so let's take a look at some of these other things. Mary Beth says, Jesus simply says, be reconciled. And, all right, that means make friends again. It's what the word reconciliation means. And so that's what our goal is, to try to be friends again, put this behind us. All right, so verses 27 through 32, it says this, you have heard that it was said, you shall not commit adultery. But I say to you that everyone who looks at a woman with lustful intent has already committed adultery with her in his heart. This is English Standard Version, by the way. If your right eye causes you to sin, tear it out and throw it away. For it's better that you lose one of your members than that your whole body be thrown into hell. And if your right hand causes you to sin, cut it off and throw it away. For it's better that you lose one of your members than that your whole body go into hell. It was also said, these are really two similar topics, but they're not the same. It was also said, whoever divorces his wife, let him give her a certificate of divorce. But I say to you that everyone, I do want you to emphasize everyone. If you got your Bible out, I want you to circle, underline everyone. Because some people say the God, Jesus' law of divorce, it's only for the believers. This passage says whoever, and it says everyone. This is not just a law for believers. It's for everyone. I say to you that everyone who divorces his wife, except on the ground of sexual morality, makes her commit adultery. And whoever marries a divorced woman commits adultery. That's someone who's been put away. All right. So let's take a look at our questions here surrounding this text. And we could probably go on forever about this, but we're going to try to hit some main points here. The Old Testament and Jewish teachers, they would have spoken against the sin of adultery, right? It's one of the Ten Commandments. You shall not commit adultery. What does Jesus teach as the real problem which leads to adultery?
In the hearts of men.
Hearts of men. It's when you look at a woman, or if we were to flip-flop the genders, look at a man to lust. Look at her with lustful intent in your heart. Where is the right place for lust? Where does God want that to be fulfilled when it comes to sensual lust?
Where is the right place? There is no right place, is there?
Marriage, the right place. Where's the marriage?
Yeah.
I hope it's okay in marriage. Yeah. In Hebrews 13 and verse 4, it says that the marriage bed is undefiled. In other words, it's okay to have a lustful relationship in marriage. Marriage is honorable among all. The bed is undefiled, but fornicators and adulterers God will judge. So there's a contrast there between the lust that rightfully takes place in a marriage and the lust that unlawfully takes place either prior to marriage or with someone else besides your marriage partner. And so that's the key issue that Jesus is dealing with, is not having a desire for your marriage partner. Having that desire for anybody else besides your marriage partner is wrong. And that's at the heart of adultery. It's when our thoughts and our heart is not pure. Any thoughts on this before we get to the next question here?
You know, again, we've got that Old Testament example with David and Bathsheba. You know, that David looked upon Bathsheba and he lusted after her, and then just the whole chain of events of things that went wrong. You know, it all started with that lust of him seeing her bathing. And so, you know, it's funny because Jesus is kind of having to go back and reteach these things that we've already seen, you know, kind of the cause and effect from the Old Testament to, you know, this is really what leads to these sorts of sins happening.
Mm-hmm. Good. Okay. So
throw a fun fact out there. That word lust is actually the same one used to desire after God and desire righteousness. So that word's actually used a ton in other places other than just the lustful way. So we need to have that type of strong, deep-seated heart desire in many other applications of life, not just marriage.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Good. Good thoughts. Well, Jesus offers some hyperbolic advice. You know, he speaks in hyperbole. I think it's important to emphasize that because I don't think Jesus is saying, cut your eye out. If you're having a problem looking at, you know, women, just cut your eye out. By the way, if you cut your right eye out, don't you still have a left eye? Yeah, so I don't think that's going to fix the problem either. You still got one eye. But he's speaking in exaggerated language here. So how would we put this practical advice into plain English if we were to help somebody else with the problem of lust?
Not to put ourselves in situations where we would have an opportunity to do that.
Okay. So that's good. Try not to put yourselves in situations where you could look at something to lust at. Okay.
Job puts it as, I've made a covenant with my eyes.
Okay. Good. Good.
The fact that he's not going to allow his eyes to linger on something like that. And there's, you know, a lot of different books out there and teachings, you know, kind of the idea of bouncing your eyes. If you see something like that, don't sit there and fix it on it, but move away from it.
Okay. All right. I think what I would say to somebody, if one thing, just you got to cut it out, whatever it is. If it's your computer, you've got to cut it out. You've got to take away some of the temptation. That's going to help. That's not going to fix it completely. It's also going to change your heart and your mind. But there are certain ways we can not put ourselves in situations, and in places where we find it easier to either look or to touch, avoid the sources of temptation. And so, Jesus is saying, cut it out. Now, taking a look at the next question here, which would be Matthew 5, 31 and 32. Let's take a look at these questions. I'm going to skip over this quote. All right. So we're looking at the subject of divorce in verses 31 and 32. And according to Matthew 5, 31, the beliefs of many with regard to divorce were pretty broad in the time of Christ. So what one reason does Jesus give for divorce in Matthew 5 and verse 32? What is the one justifiable reason?
Unfaithfulness.
Adultery, yes.
Sexual immorality.
Okay, sexual morality. Thanks, Ed. And I get a little technical when we start looking at Matthew 5, 31 and 32 and passages like Matthew chapter 19 and verse 9, because I think it's very important that we use words the way that they're used in scripture. Some versions actually do say unfaithfulness. I can't remember which one it is, but might be the NIV if I remember correctly, but unfaithfulness is a word that gets used, but unfaithfulness can also be kind of a broad word. I think the more appropriate word is sexual immorality. There has to have been sexual unfaithfulness specifically. You know, I could make the argument that if we're just saying unfaithfulness, that, you know, if I ask my wife to sweep out my car, and she didn't do it, she's being unfaithful to me. Well, not in the sense Jesus is talking about here, okay? We're talking about sexual immorality, sexual unfaithfulness, is the word that's used. And so it's important to kind of understand what those terms mean. Now, according to Jesus, again, this isn't the teaching of Josh Welch, although I hope the teaching of Josh Welch is the teaching of Jesus, but it doesn't originate with me. If one chooses to marry a person who has been put away, then what sin does that person commit?
Adultery.
Okay. Now, sexual immorality and adultery are not the same words either. Now, there's two different Greek words. That's why they're translated in two different ways. Okay. Sexual immorality is a very broad word that can apply to premarital sex, and it can apply to a sexual affair. It can apply to homosexuality or even bestiality. It's a very broad term. Adultery specifically is when we remarry and engage in a sexual relationship with someone that we don't have the right to be married to. Okay, so either you were married and you put your spouse away for an unlawful reason and you got married, or you were put away and you choose to get remarried, you are then guilty of adultery. And I want to think with you for a minute about how we use those terms. What are the differences? Anybody think about that with me? Kind of explain it. What are the differences between sexual immorality and adultery?
To me, as far as I understand it, sexual immorality is literally everything other than one man, one woman in a marriage. Anything outside of that that's sexual immorality. And okay. Adultery is simply anything that is with a married woman that is not supposed to be, basically.
Okay. All right. Now, I would argue that in English, we use the word adultery to mean, like, if you've had an affair, then you're guilty of adultery. That's how we use the term. But technically, if you're getting kind of technical with this passage, okay, the adultery is the remarriage to someone and thus engaging in a sexual relationship. Whoever marries a woman who is divorced commits adultery. the adultery is actually the remarriage to someone you don't have the right to have a sexual relationship with. I just kind of point that out because we have a scarlet letter way of defining adultery, you know. I think it was Hester Prynne in Scarlet Letter. If you ever read that book, you know, where they had to wear the A on their chest, and she was an adulteress because she was just having an affair with someone. But technically, in the Greek language, what we see in Matthew 5 is that it's the remarriage, having a sexual relationship with someone you didn't have the right to. And I think that'll get borne out in Matthew 19 as well. But just a couple of points to make about that, because, you know, marriage, divorce, and remarriage is a pretty important topic for us to study and to think about. And certainly we need to make sure we try to get it right so we understand it ourselves and so that the people we study with also get it right. All right. So just a couple of points I wanted to think about. Well, let's finish up with verses 33 through 37. We looked at what Christ taught about hatred in verses 21 through 26. We've looked at what Christ has said about lust and also how that can affect your marriage in verses 27 through 32. But let's take a look at what Jesus teaches about honesty and truthfulness in verses 33 through 37. All right. So Jesus says, again, you have heard that it was said to those of old, you shall not swear falsely, but shall perform to the Lord what you have sworn. But I say to you, do not take an oath at all, either by heaven, for it's the throne of God, or by the earth, for it is his footstool, or by Jerusalem, for it's the city of the great king. And do not take an oath by your head, for you cannot make one hair white or black. Let what you say be simply yes or no. Anything more than this comes from evil. Okay? So I want you to put your head around kind of maybe what some of the people in Jesus' day were saying. I like to compare this to, have you ever heard somebody say, well, I did make a promise, but I had my fingers crossed. So therefore, I can break the promise. That, yeah, you guys ever played that little game with somebody? That's dishonest, right? We would see that as a kind of a dishonest thing. Now, in Jesus' time, people might say, well, I swear by heaven above, or I swear by the throne of God, or I swear by God's created earth. I swear by Jerusalem, the city of holy Jerusalem, that I'm telling the truth. All right. These are things that people would have said in Jesus' time. And I think Jesus is making the point, you shouldn't have to swear if you're a follower of him, because you should always be honest. And honest people don't have to swear. Honest people always tell the truth. Their yes always means yes, and their no always means no. So Jesus is dealing with honesty. So let's take a look at the questions as we kind of finish up this thought here. I got to read you a couple of these quotes because this is a fantastic explanation, I think, of what's going on here. But Barclay says this, in the time of Jesus, there were two unsatisfactory things about taking oaths. The first was what might be called frivolous swearing, taking an oath where no oath was necessary or proper. It had become far too common a custom to introduce a statement by saying, by thy life, by my head, or may I never see the comfort of Israel if... the rabbis laid it down to use any form of oath in a simple statement. It was sinful and it was wrong. The yes of the righteous is yes, they said, and their no is no. Jesus is really agreeing with what the rabbis taught, maybe not what they practiced as much. The second Jewish custom was in some ways even worse than that. It might be called evasive swearing. The Jews divided oaths into two classes, those which were absolutely binding, in those which were not. Any oath which contained the name of God was held to not be binding. The result was that if a man swore by the name of God in any form, like I swear by Jerusalem, I swear by God's footstool, if he swore by any God in any form, he would rigidly keep that oath. But if he swore by heaven or by earth or by Jerusalem or by his head, he felt quite free to break that oath. And the result was that evasion had been brought to a fine art. We will regard all promises as sacred if we remember that all promises are made in the presence of God. And so I think Jesus is just encouraging honesty. The Old Testament teaches quite a bit on the subject of vows, oaths, and honesty. So Jesus clearly says you shouldn't have to swear here. You shouldn't have to make an oath. Let's take a look at the last question, though. I'm answering all my own questions. What does Jesus expect from his followers according to Matthew 5:37? And what are some of the simple ways, common ways people lie today? How might we be guilty of that? How might people be guilty of?
This is much.
I hear somebody speaking up there. I don't know if you meant to. Guess not.
Josh, I would say stretching the truth.
Okay. Stretching the truth. That's a phrase that we use. I wasn't lying. I was just stretching the truth a little bit.
Anything that is meant to deceive somebody. If you say something that you purposefully mean to allow this person or to have this person think something that is not true, you are being deceptive and dishonest, and you are lying. Whether it's a whether it's an obvious lie or not, it's still a lie. Whether it's wrapped up in a bunch of truth or whatever, any portion of dishonesty there is a lie.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Good. I've heard people say, I didn't lie, I was just fibbing. Still sound like a lie to me. You can call it whatever you want. But we've got to be people who are truthful.
Robert.
That sounds like a Robert voice. I can't see you, but it sounds like you.
It reminds me of Matthew chapter 23, verse 16. Woe to you, blind guides, who say, whoever swears by the temple, it is nothing. But whoever swears by the gold of the temple, he's obliged to perform it. You know, and today we have things like, you know, classic case. I asked a student to sit down and he just slowly takes his time, taking the most indirect route possible. And he says, well, you never said, you know, how quickly I had to sit down. You know, it's little things like that, that that's kind of what we've been talking about though, with this whole lesson. It really is a hard issue. You know, we can say, well, I was doing as you asked, but if it wasn't with the right heart, then it doesn't matter. We're still disobeying.
All right. Good. Rebecca Campbell raised her hand. All right, Rebecca. What you got?
Just something that we actually did this with my kids today, and I pulled out my book. So I'm hoping you guys can see this. This is what we talked about today. The behavior is the lying, but the emotion, the thoughts, and the beliefs, that's what the root is. The heart is what we've been saying. So, it's something where we do have to control our emotions, our thoughts, our beliefs, and then our behavior is going to reflect that.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's a great point. That's a great way to kind of bring it all together. What we're talking about. God is a God of truth. And as Christians, we have to be people of truth. And if those are our beliefs, those are our thoughts that we follow a God of truth who expects us to be people of truth, then we're going to do what Ephesians 4:25 says, put away lying and speak truth with one another. James 5:12 says, let your yes be yes and your no, no. And so we're going to see it in our fruit. You're right. If the root is truly in God, we're going to see that in our, so that's a good. That's a good point. Bob put in here, sometimes we lie by omission. I think that's a great point, too. We could turn this into a whole lesson about lying, but sometimes we lie by leaving information out that would be important for people to know because we're intentionally trying to deceive. All right. Guys, you know, one last thought that I had as I think about this last question is that how many times do we sing songs to God where we're making promises to him? I will work. I will pray. I will labor every day in the vineyard of the Lord. And Is it possible that we could be saying things in our songs that we aren't actually putting into practice? We need to be truthful, not just in what we say, but in what we sing when we worship. Our prayers need to come from hearts of truth. And so this is such an important thing for us to use to search ourselves and let God, you know, cleanse out any impurity that he sees in us, whether it be hatred that we talked about earlier and unbridled anger, whether it be that lust that is causing us to violate our marriage relationship, or whether it just be a lack of truthfulness. We need to be people who are honest and transparent, clear with people. So, well, thank you so much for everybody listening around. Anybody have a final comment that they want to share or say or chat with? That's all I've got for today.
I guess just one thing I also want to point out is, you know, words can be deceptive. I mean, just like the words we can sing in a hymn, or, you know, we say a really well worded together apology. But then in our heart, we don't really have a very repentive attitude about it. So, you know, words can be deceptive. It's our actions that really show where it is. Okay.
Thank you, Robert.